call the meeting of the Subcommittee Employee Relations to order. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm not sure what's going on with the heat in the state office building this morning, but it's definitely on and warm, and sorry about that. And apologies to the legislators. I'm blaming Mr. Hubinger, essentially, for this, scheduling our meeting this morning during the conference at and some you'll have to explain yourself to Representative Pepin because she needs class credit at the conference, and maybe we can give her special dispensation or something. But well, welcome. Thank you for coming. And we have three contracts this morning that we're hoping to approve, and we're starting here with this Minnesota State University system. And please state your names and go ahead when you're ready.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Senators, Representatives, good morning. My name is Mark Carlson. I am the Vice Chancellor of Human Resources for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. With me at the table today is Mr. Chris Dale, Senior System Director for Labor Relations. We're here today to provide the subcommittee with an overview of the tentative agreement reached between the Minsky Board of Trustees and the Minnesota State University Association of Administrative and Service Faculty, sometimes referred to as MUSAF, and the tentative agreement reached with the Minnesota State College faculty, also referred to as MSCF. In addition to Mr. Dale, who will shortly review the terms of these two tentative agreements, I have with me today, seated in the audience, Ms. Betsy Thompson and Mr. Jeff Wade, who respectively served as the system's chief spokespersons in negotiation with these exclusive representatives. If there are any questions that Mr. Dale or I are not able to answer, you may call upon Ms. Thompson or Mr. Wade to assist us in responding.
Sure.
Let's begin with the Minnesota State University Association of Administrative and Service Faculty. MUSAF represents professional, non-instructional faculty who work with students in student service programs at our state universities. As of fiscal year 2013, the base year for comparison purposes, there were approximately 770 employees in the MUSAF unit. The bargaining parties reached a tentative agreement on May 23, 2014. After receiving verification that the tentative agreement had been ratified by a vote of the membership of MUSAF, the Minsky Board of Trustees approved the tentative agreement at its regularly scheduled meeting on Wednesday, June 18th. Turning now to the Minnesota State College faculty, MSCF represents the traditional teaching faculty at our two-year state community and technical college. As of fiscal year 2013, the base year for comparison purposes, there were approximately 5,280 employees in the MSCF unit. The bargaining parties reached a tentative agreement on June 4, 2014, after receiving verification that the tentative agreement had been ratified by a vote of the membership of MSCF. The Minsky Board of Trustees approved the tentative agreement at a special meeting called for that purpose on July 23rd of this year. As indicated on the settlement cost sheet distributed by Mr. Hubinger's summary, the cost to the employer of the two tentative agreements before you today is comparable to the cost of the agreements reached between MMB and the state's classified units. At this point, I will ask Mr. Dale to review the economic and significant language changes included in these two tentative agreements. Mr. Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Dale?
Mr. Chair, Senators and Representatives, my name is Chris Dale. Starting with MUSAF, during the fiscal year 2014, the tentative agreement provides for a 2.4% schedule enhancement for returning MUSAF members, and that's effective July 1st, 2013. And the insurance benefits were comparable to those negotiated by MMB classified units. In fiscal year 2015, the tentative agreement provides for a 2.6% salary schedule enhancement and a one-step movement for returning ASF members, and those are effective on July 1, 2014, just a couple of months ago. There is a 3% lump sum for returning ASF members who are at the top step and cannot have a step increase because as a result of being at the top of the schedule. So there's a one-time lump sum equivalent to 3% salary for those who cannot receive the step increase. And there's a comparable schedule enhancement for the medical directors and health service direct physicians. They are not actually on a step of the salary schedule, so they can't get a step, so they get a 3% increase to their salary. The tentative agreement provides a $500 lump sum for returning ASF members who were hired on or before July 1, 2009, after who remained continuously employed at their current university. Again, the insurance benefits were as negotiated by MMB and classified units. The language changes for the MUSAF agreement can't be characterized as major, and I'll just cover really a list of what are not really major language changes. The parties agreed to extend the employer's ability to use an intermittent appointment status type, and that's located in Article 10 of the agreement. We simplify the notice periods for non-renewal of probationary faculty members. We increased the honoraria amount that can be paid to an ASF member from $1,000 to $2,000 per fiscal year. And we clarified the treatment that vacation balances will be given upon transfer into the unit or transfer between in-unit positions. And finally, we made professional mass printing of the collective bargaining agreement optional, since we are all moving into the modern era of no hard copies. Turning to MSCF, if there are no questions about these.
Members, is there any questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, can you review again? You said, trying to follow what you were saying, the medical directors and health service positions, 2.4% increase, and then 5.6, I get that. And then 3%, something about a 3% increase because they don't have steps in that particular area?
The medical directors and the health service physicians aren't on the traditional salary schedule, so they're not on a step. So the step increase that is being awarded to the other unit members cannot have, because they don't have step movement. So instead, in lieu of the step movement, they're getting a 3% increase to their base salary, which is approximately what the average step in this unit is worth.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, obviously there's a reason they don't have the steps in that particular area. Can you review those reasons for us and what the history is? Has this been done before?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the medical physicians and health, medical directors and health service physicians, since I have been employed with Minsky, which is beginning in 1996, have not been on a step in the salary schedule. And the reason, as I understand it, has been for market reasons, that it's just simply hard to attract folks with those types of credentials on the salary schedule that currently exists in the
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, so Mr. Dale, has the legislature ratified contracts before for this particular subgroup that have an automatic 3% supposedly or apparently to act in lieu of what their neighboring and their bargaining neighboring people got?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, there have been prior settlements that were ratified by the legislature that provided for a step increase, a percentage increase to the medical directors and health service physicians' base salary that was comparable to the average step increase. Yes. So the short answer to your question is yes, that is what has happened. I should note that these are not automatic. They don't happen every time a year occurs. They have to be negotiated each and every contract.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, characterize, if you will, how often does this happen in this particular area, and how often is there not a supplemental amount similar to this 3% piece offered to that group?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I'm immediately familiar with the last 6 years covered by the last three contract settlements, including this one, if you can include this one. And in fiscal years 2011, 2012, and 2013, there simply was no increase for this unit. So there was no increase for the health care, the health service physicians and the medical directors. There was an increase in fiscal year 2014. I don't believe it included a step. So this would have only occurred when there had been step increases, and they have not occurred every year. There would only be this arrangement to provide the health the medical directors and health service physicians a comparable increase to what the rest of the unit got in those years in which there was a step increase, because the medical directors and the health service physicians can't get step moving.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's good. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Woolley, and I guess either of you, Mr. Dale, probably. I think I missed something there on which line. For the medical directors and health services positions, it outlines an 8% increase between 2013 and 2014 on the sheet that I got from Mr. Hubinger. Was that 3% that you mentioned that it wasn't a – they don't receive step increases, and then there's – so there's a 3% total that could be added, but it's not done every year. But is that on top of that 8%? Or of the 2.4% increase in 2013 and 5.6% increase in 2014? Or is that included in there? So is it 8% plus a potential additional 3% on that?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the 3% that you're referring to would be included in the figure that Mr. Hubinger referred to, an overall aggregate increase over the two-year period of 8%.
Gotcha. Thank you. And then, Representative Lilly, if you allow me a few questions. And then on... I don't know. Do you have a copy of from Mr. Hubinger? That might be easier to follow along if you had that. I'm looking on, I guess it's page 2 of the Hubinger handout on number 8. It talks about the Exceptional Achievement Program, a lump sum payment of 5% to the employee salary, but this doesn't say if it's, is it the faculty, or does it also include the medical directors and health service physicians? It says, I think only 10% of them get it, but to me, if my numbers are right, it looks like you could potentially get a 13% if you add the 8%, whether you're a faculty or medical director or health service physician. And then if you get this exceptional achievement program, it's an additional 5%. So that for some employees, it could be a 13% increase. If you could just clarify that. And then also, does it apply to all three of these categories, or is it just faculty, or who does it apply to?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the Exceptional Achievement Program would be available to all members of the unit. However, it is a fairly lightly used provision because the standards and showings are fairly rigorous. And so I'm not aware that medical directors have, in fact, obtained the 5% bump for exceptional achievement. But in theory, they could be a part of a group that set forth a program that resulted in an exceptional achievement award.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Lilly. And it says in here that you said it's pretty unusual, but you know it looks like it's 10% could be eligible for that. Is that a correct number?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, what the contract provides is up to 10%, so that 10% is a cap on the total number of employees that could conceivably be eligible for the Exceptional Achievement Program. And if I did not clarify earlier, I should now, that the Exceptional Achievement payment is a lump sum payment, so it is not added to the base salary.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lilly and Mr. Dale. Well, it would still be, I understand that 5% wouldn't be added to the lump sum, nor would the 3% for the medical directors and health service physicians, but it still would be, you could look at it as a 13% increase if you were to get the 8% for 2013 and 2014 plus a lump sum of 5%. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, normally in the HR community, we do not refer to lump sum payments as a salary increase. I would they're awarded, it's a lump sum, and they're not awarded again. There's no promise that they will be awarded again. So it's probably fair to say that the ASF faculty who received the 5% lump sum in the year that they received that award. It augmented their salary, but it's not a base salary increase.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lillian. Mr. Dale, that's fair enough. I would argue that it is a 13% increase on the year that they received the lump sum. But just to provide me a little bit more context, I know at some of these we've had a little bit more detail on salary scales. And so, you know, a percent increase is a lot different if you make $40,000 or if you make $110,000. So could you talk a little bit? I don't know if you have any paperwork there. Can you talk a little bit about the average, perhaps, faculty salary or the administrative and health service physicians and medical directors? Could you talk about the average of each of those, just so I can put this in context a little bit of what these folks are making? And also, if you did mention, I think, that it was that you had difficulty attracting folks with their credentials. I'm just wondering I wouldn't expect this today, but I'd just be curious to see the comparison of what the private sector would make versus the public sector, because I think that that's probably true, that it is harder with some of these positions to get folks to come into the kind of a public sector position. But it would be interesting for me to be able to kind of look at that.
Mr. Dale, do you need the second part restated, or did you catch that too?
It might be helpful to have the second part.
The first part was just kind of getting an average salary for the different faculty, and I guess across the board, any of these contracts, the average salary is always helpful to know, so I can kind of get a context of what it would look like for an average individual. And then the second part is, I'm just wondering if at some point, and I wouldn't expect that today, I could get more of an idea of kind of a comparison. You said it's hard to attract folks with the credentials. I guess I'm not sure what that would look like, who you're attracting from the private sector, some kind of a comparison. So I'm having a hard time understanding a little bit about the attracting folks. So it'd be helpful to see some kind of a comparison. I understand it can't be apples to apples because you're looking at different sectors, but if you have some kind of a methodology, that would be helpful. But would you have the average salaries of these by any chance available?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, as I sit here today, I don't know the average salary for the ASF unit. I do know that the medical directors and the health service physicians make fairly good salaries for state service, and they're making approximately somewhere between $140,000 and $160,000. These folks are doctors or nurse practitioners, so they are highly qualified individuals to engage in the practice that they're engaged in, and the market is fairly competitive. I don't know salaries in the medical market as I sit here today.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lillian. And Mr. Dale, on a line, there's another special initiative program. I won't get into that, although it looks like another award of $5,000 as a lump sum, which would be a larger increase for the year in which they receive that. But I'll skip to number 10, the continued tuition waiver for employees of up to 27 credits per year. What is the average value of that? Would that go to kids of employees, the employees themselves, would it go to grandkids of employees? How widely is that available? If I were an employee, could I allow my nephew or niece to get some credits, or how does that work?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the tuition waiver benefit, I believe that the average credit value for tuition right now is about $145. I'm not absolutely sure as I sit here. But I cannot tell you, I don't know, as I sit here, the rate of usage of the tuition waiver benefit by ASF members. The benefit is available to employees, and it is available to the employee's spouse and dependent children. And it is not available beyond that. So nieces and nephews and in-laws are not covered by the benefit.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. That's helpful. And then could you, the this stuff with the sabbatical for employees with at least 6 years of service. Could you just talk a little bit about how that compares to other systems in other states, or is that pretty typical, or is that, you know, better or worse than what other states do on average?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, we have found that faculty units virtually across the board have access to sabbatical-type leaves in their arrangements with their colleges and universities. And with the two faculty contracts that the other faculty contract that comes before you today and the faculty contract that the Minsky system just settled with the state university faculty, both those contracts provide for sabbaticals on similar kind of terms, not identical, but similar terms overall. The USAF unit is probably notable that the actual usage of the sabbatical is fairly low, I think, compared to the other two traditional faculty units.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I kind of figured it was similar. I understand the sabbaticals are big in the education world. And then could you comment a little bit on number 13 on this list, maybe 12 and 13, the 5% increase in salary in the employee's final year of employment if the employment provides 6 months' notice? It looks like there's, you know, a lot of early retirement incentives. And if you're having difficulty attracting employees because of the, you know, exceedingly low salary range, why is there a need for the employee providing or getting incentives for retiring early and getting, looks like, additional money for retiring earlier than there than perhaps you would in another career field?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, well, there are a number of potential benefits that you covered in your question, so I'll try to address each one. The early retirement incentive, which is not number 13, but the early retirement incentive that's available under the USAF contract has actually been discretionary since the 95-97 agreement that was negotiated by, it was the Minsky's first contract. Obviously, the contract existed prior to the formation of Minsky, but prior to the formation of Minsky, the early retirement incentive was mandatory, and it was Minsky that negotiated to become optional. And therefore, because it's discretionary, it can actually serve the intended purpose of early retirement incentives, which is to stimulate or incent a retirement at times that you want to incent retirement, and then you don't award it when you don't want to incent retirement. So that's the discretionary function allows the president of each state university to make decisions like that, is that this is a time when we want to incent retirements or not. The early notice incentive which is embodied in number 13 in Mr. Hubinger's summary, is a different. Its purpose is different. These positions tend to be filled by national searches, and those types of searches take a little time. And so the reason this is included is to try to assure that we get advance notice. With ample time to conduct a search to fill the position when employees are choosing to retire. And so we provide a financial incentive to them to give us that advance notice so that it allows the university, it gives the university an administrative break, as it were, so they can conduct the search. Did I cover?
Representative Pepin.
I think I just have one more question in this section, and it relates to this topic. You mentioned, Mr. Dale, that sometimes you might want to have an early retirement incentive, and sometimes you might not. What would be an example of why you'd incent someone to retire early? Is it because of the cost, and it was cheaper to get somebody younger in, or and then is it found this is a cost savings by getting 55-year-old professors, for example, to retire? Does that result in a net savings by getting in someone younger, or is that the main reason for why you'd get someone to incent them to retire earlier? If you could kind of comment on that, when that would be used.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, yes, budgets are largely the main reason that would drive decision-making around early retirement incentives. Of course, we're not interested in necessarily getting younger folks, as opposed to not younger folks, but we would be interested in achieving any cost savings we could through by replacing people or not replacing people, and if we do replace them, at a lower position on the salary schedule.
Thank you.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, on number 13, kind of the same vein of discussion of Representative Pepin's questions. This early retirement notice incentive, and I appreciate the context and the history. You said the 95 to 97 contract, and it went from mandatory to discretionary for the agency. Characterize the retirement implications that that has on the retirement costs for those individuals.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, just to be so I can be clear, it was the early retirement incentive, not the early notice, that became discretionary in the 95-97 contract. The impact of the early retirement notice on the retirement costs is negligible because TRA does not review this particular increase as is subject to retirement withhold.
So
it's not calculated for purposes of calculating retirement benefits.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale.
Mr. Dale, could you please proceed into the next section, please?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move on now to the MSCF agreement. The tentative agreement with MSCF in fiscal year 2014 provides for a 3% salary schedule enhancement effective July 1, 2013. And again, it provides insurance benefits as negotiated by MMB with the state's classified bargaining units. In fiscal year 2015, the tentative agreement provides for a step increase for faculty who are returning, and that is effective as of July 1, 2014. And then effective January 1, 2015, there is another 3% salary schedule enhancement. Again, insurance benefits are as negotiated by MMB with the state's classified units. As it was with USAF, the language changes with MSCF really cannot be characterized as major language changes. I'll give you a short sample of the type of language changes which were negotiated. Language is added to clarify the office hour responsibilities of online faculty. Language was added to clarify how sick leave and bereavement leave and personal leave are used by online faculty when colleges are closed by a president, temporarily closed due to, for example, a weather emergency. Language was added to provide for liquidation of the insurance benefit component of the early retirement incentive. Language was added to clarify the limitations on early retirement benefits for certain former school district employees who were absorbed in the Minsky system when it was formed in 1995. And language was added that ends the rounding of credits a faculty member receives when given an internship supervision assignment. So now it will be a fraction of credit that was actually earned.
Mr. Dale, is this would Representative Isaacson be one of these employees? You don't have to answer. We're just going to want to know how good of a worker he is. Comment on that,
Mr. Chair. I regret to say that I don't really have detailed knowledge of the work habits of the MSCF.
Okay. Sure. Senator Metzen.
Yeah, I should know this, but maybe Mr. Hubinger or Mr. Dale would know. What were the settlements in 10 and 11 and 12?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, the MSCF agreement was similar to MUSAF in the sense that for fiscal years 11 and 12 and 13, there were no increases. And that the increases that have occurred recently have occurred in fiscal year 13, 14, and 15. There were no in 4, 10, 11, and 12.
I Yeah, I guess I thought I knew the answer, and there was no increase for 2.5 years or 3 years.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's a 3 full years. That was
3 full years, okay. Thank you.
Representative Kaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, remind me, many of the contracts that may not have had across-the-board increases had step increases during those times. Did these contracts did this contract have step increases? And then the other question is, I think, is this contract is actually retroactive to 2013 as well, so that cuts into one of those 3 years that was just previously discussed.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, the MSCF contract, like the USAF contract and the IFO contracts that Minsky negotiates, do not provide for automatic step increases. They must be negotiated each round of negotiations. It is the case that the 3% salary schedule enhancement for fiscal year 14 commences on July 1, 2013, but that's when fiscal year 14 commences. What I said previously is still the case, which is that there were no salary increases for fiscal years 10, 11, and 12.
Representative Pepin. Oh, Representative Draskowski, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, were there any decreases in those years?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, there were no negotiated decreases in salaries during those years.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, I find that very good treatment of our employees, given the fact that the private sector from 2008 up through 2012 saw a lot of decreases in a lot of areas. It would appear very clearly that given that reality that this particular group of faculty was treated very well by the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Pepin.
Thanks. Were you finished just talking about that section, or do you have more to say? I have a few questions after that.
Chair, Representative
Mr.
Pepin,
Dale.
I was finished with those remarks.
Okay.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. And this was my mistake. This is going back to the first, the administrative and service faculty contract. I'm sorry. I just thought of another question. On number 11 on the Hubinger sheet, it says, talks about the sabbaticals for employees with at least 6 years of service. And I just wanted to clarify, it says the bargaining unit includes 740 faculty in admissions, financial aid, housing, and student services positions. Could you just clarify who exactly is eligible for sabbatical? Are all those employees eligible, or is there a subset that are eligible?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the USAF unit includes what we call the administrative and service faculty. These are not traditional teaching faculty. These are employees that work with student services and student programs. So such things as financial aid, housing, bursar, the registrar, those folks who work with students and student programs. The unit covers a wide range of services and employees working providing those services. Those folks in the unit who have 6 years of service in are eligible to apply for a sabbatical. But applying for a sabbatical is not as easy as simply sending a note to the president saying, "I'd like to take sabbatical next year." And pack your bags, you actually have to put together a sabbatical plan, and you're expected to complete the plan.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Billy and Mr. Dale. So anyone under the categories I've listed could technically, it may be more difficult, but they could technically qualify for a sabbatical?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, yes, people who meet the necessary service requirements in the unit are eligible to apply for a sabbatical.
Representative Pepin.
And then, thank you. And then on the other contract, the State College faculty contract, could you just, I want to just clarify in lines 1, 2, and 3, the increases from July 1st, 2013, 14, and 15. So it would be a 3% additional step, so that would be added to the base, and then July 14th, and a 3.5% increase, so that would be a 6.5% increase, and then 2015 receive an across-the-board increase of 3.0, is that added to the base? Are these all added to the base, or is it some of it lump sum? Or is I'm wondering if it's a 9.5% total between the 3 years, or if you could just clarify.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. The 3% salary schedule enhancement effective on July 1, 2013 does affect the base salary and affects the base salary of all those folks who have a set already established salary in the unit. The salary step that is provided for on July 1, 2014 is available to those folks who were previously in the unit because there is a salary schedule with steps on it. And it does affect the base salary of those people who are able to move, but there are approximately 26% or so of the unit at the top step, and they're not able to move as a result of a salary step increase. Again, the 3% salary schedule enhancement effective on January 1, 2015 does affect all those employees who have a salary already established at that time, and it does affect the base salary.
Representative Pepin.
So just to clarify then, so the July 1st, 2013 would apply to all, and the 2015 would apply to all, and the 2014 would also add to the base, but only to about 74%. Is that accurate?
Mr. Dale.
Yes, that is more or less accurate. The approximately 26% or so, it might be a little bit higher than that, of the unit is at the top step, so cannot have step move.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Lilly. I might need you to repeat that last part. So I'm trying to figure out, would 74 or 75% get basically 9.5% increases added to the base, or is it just that I'm confused about whether it's 74% that get it or 26% that get it?
Mr.
The second part.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, with respect to the step increase, it's approximately 26% that do not get it.
Not get it. Okay, thank you.
If I may, you're adding the three columns together. It's somewhat more complicated than that with this unit and step movement, because the steps are an absolute dollar value apart, or were traditionally before we added this 3% increase. The relative value of the step depends on what your salary was before you took the step movement. And so for faculty who were newer to the system and were on a lower step of the salary schedule, the step movement represents, relatively speaking, a larger percent increase to their salary, because it's an absolute, it used to be $1,750 each step was worth, and $1,750 is simply a larger percentage of $40,000 than it is $60,000, for example. And so the relative value of the step movement depends on what your salary was before the step took place. We have done a computation and taken a look at what the weighted average of the value of the step movement was, and it turns out that it's about 2.8% for the unit as a whole. That's not what the average step is. That's a weighted average of what the unit is experiencing as a result of its step movement based on the salaries before and after.
Okay. Sort of a clarifying question, and then okay, I'll let you go to Representative Drazkowski for a second before I...
Representative Pepin.
Could you... I don't know if you have this available today, but again, with this contract, I'm wondering if you, just to provide some context, if you know the average salary, or if not, if you could provide that later before we take this up in the legislature. The legislature.
Mr. Dale. Looks like you dialed
Mr.
a friend. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, we actually do... with this unit and the IFO unit, try to take a fairly careful analysis with their how they compare to the compare to others, and the average salary for this unit is approximately
$63,000.
Thank you. You're
done? Oh. I'm not done, but he was wanting to ask questions.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, can you walk through that again? So. I don't know. My mind's not wrapping around this very well. So there's a base increase July 1st, 2013 of 3%. And that affects everybody. Is that right? And there's
Mr.
a base Dale. There's a base increase on January 1st, 2015 that affects everybody of 3%. And then the July 1st, 2014, can you talk about that again, Mr. Dale?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, yes, effective July 1, 2014, faculty members who were not at the top of the salary range and who were on step in the prior year will move advance one step in the salary range. And if you just look at those steps, the value of those steps across the salary schedule, and say what are they worth, you will arrive at approximately the number that Mr. Hubinger has in his report. But if you take because the steps are absolute dollar values apart, at least they were prior to the 3% increase in July 1, 2013. The relative value of each step increase depends on what your base salary was before you got the step increase. That is why I mentioned that there was a weighted average value of 2.8% across the unit if you take a look at what those steps actually do on the average to faculty in the unit.
Representative Drazkowski.
So, Mr. Dale, under number one there, it says an additional step is added between the penultimate. What's that mean, Mr. Hubinger? It must be the first one, huh?
Do you want to handle that, Mr. Hubinger, or can we give that to Mr. Dale?
Who wrote that?
That's
not my vocabulary yet.
Mr. Dale and I share that term a lot. It's the second to the last step.
Oh, thank you. So what does this mean then, Mr. Dale, that sentence with penultimate in it?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, there was an odd feature to the MSCF agreement that this adding the step to the penultimate step was intended to cure, which was the last step in the MSCF agreement had always been effectively a double step. And so this was intended to end the practice of having the double step that created a very large increase for those people who moved up a step. And that's what this was intended to do. It does not actually by itself increase salaries. In fact, it avoided the problem of having people take the double step as opposed to a single step, which was then the last step was essentially divided into two steps.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you. So, Mr. Dale, how did that double step, how did that develop? Where did that come from?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, that actually precedes my knowledge of the MSCF agreement, although it's possible that Mr. Wade knows the origins or Ms. Munoz knows the origins of the double step.
Is it right next to the two step?
Mr. Marvel, do you know?
No one knows, Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
I'm still not clear on what our total is there. It looks like, again, very generous amounts for each of those years. Mr. Dale, as you went through the other provisions under this section of our discussion today, you said this one was added and this one was added. Which numbers are new then again? Can I circle those if you could go through which numbers are new ones to the contract?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, although I reviewed Mr. Hubinger's summary, I did not read it with this goal in mind, so it will take me a moment to actually look over each item on Mr. Hubinger's summary and tell you whether it represents something new to the contract or represents something continued. So if you'll bear with me. Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, obviously items number 1, 2, and 3 on Mr. Hubinger's summary are new in that they represent salary increases. Number 4 was new. It represented a clarification, but it was new language in the contract. Number 5 and 6 are not. They were their current provisions. Number 7 is theoretically new in the sense that we are implementing the insurance changes that were implemented by MMB. Number 8 is not new. Number 9 is not new. Number 10 is not new. Number 11 is not new. And number 12 and 13 are not new. And let me just qualify my reference to number 9. Again, I mentioned that there were some clarifications and small modifications to the early retirement incentive in my presentation. And without reading each line of Mr. Hubinger's summary, I'm not sure if he's captured those. But if you'd like, I can repeat them.
Representative Drazkowski, that was a pretty good summary there.
Yeah, I guess I would just have a question, Mr. Dale. What was negotiated out of the contract, or where did the taxpayers gain in this negotiation to offset the gains or the additions for the employees?
Representative Drazkowski, is that a question or a statement?
That's a question, Mr. Chair. Were there any offsetting changes, reductions in the benefits provided in the contract to offset the additions that were in there, or were they all additions?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the benefit package was not significantly altered or reduced, but there were some changes which probably benefit the employer. The move to liquidate a portion of the insurance component of the early retirement incentive, which had previously existed in the contract, actually it has the advantage that any liquidation has, which is that it solidifies the employer's obligation on a one-time basis, and the employer can then dispose of that obligation by meeting it and not have to worry about it in the future. So in sense, that was an administrative benefit to the employer, and it ended a series of disputes that had arisen around that particular provision. Some of the other clarifications with respect to the early retirement benefits that existed in the school district contracts before Minsky was formed, and those the residues or the, those continuing those obligations continue. Clarifications around those are helpful administratively because they provide administrative clarification about who has exactly what benefits. There were not, however, substantial reductions in the value of the benefits package or in salaries.
Thank you, Mr. Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Dale. Mr. Carlson. Sorry,
Representative Lee. I just wanted to be polite and let another legislator ask some questions. I do have a few more questions on them. Could you talk a little bit about the Awards for Excellence program listed on the Hubinger sheet in number 5 on the second page? It says $2,500 for a recognizing faculty work above and beyond normal requirements. Could you just talk about who qualifies for that? What percentage of people, and what would be an example of working above and beyond normal requirements? Is that an hour requirement? You know, they're working 50 hours a week, or is it something? What would that mean?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, typically what that means is identifying a project of some kind that will be of benefit to the college, and that it's above and beyond what we would normally expect a faculty member to do in the course of their year-long duties. Or doing the project that they might be expected to do, but doing it in a really outstanding fashion, such as that some sort of extra recognition, financial recognition of it was appropriate. I believe this particular provision has been used only a little. It was incorporated into the collective bargaining agreement. Based on the philosophical view of some of the board members, and then it was negotiated into the contract, that you need to be able to reward outstanding performance financially. So these are lump sums, and they are not continuing. And it has not been used a great deal, but somewhat.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. So, Representative Lilly and Mr. Dale, would it be used less than 5% or less than 10%? And then would that be, and I'm just, and the second part of that question is, you talked about a project. I know that that university professors are known for their writing academic works, and I think they're oftentimes required to as part of their continuing tenure track. Would a particularly successful book that they've written qualify them as well? So those two questions, the percentage, and then would that the academic writings qualify?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I was advised by my colleague that, in fact, there haven't been any awards of excellence, at least in the last few years. And so that hasn't been in theory, I suppose it could reach 5%. It actually, in practice, has not. To the second part of your question, if the book project, to use your specific example, if the book project were identified ahead of time and that was the project that the faculty member wished to engage in, and it was determined by the school, while our university faculty are known for publishing a great deal, these are college faculty, not the university faculty. If that book project were identified as the project that the faculty member wanted to engage in, it was determined by the school and college administration that they had, in fact, completed the task and had done so in a superior fashion and met the criteria that had been established for this award, they could receive the award in theory for a book. Yes.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Dale. And then on 6, I don't know if you talked about it or I just missed it, the continuing funding for sabbatical backlogs at $420,000. What does that mean? Is it paying someone cash because they didn't go on a backlog, or is that you're just behind in the cost, or what does that mean?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Kevin, I will endeavor to see if I get this right, but this is a little bit complex. The MSCF agreement caps the total number of sabbaticals that can occur at any particular college. And that cap, if it is reached and there are still faculty who are eligible for and have applied for a sabbatical, there is essentially a backlog list of people who might still have an opportunity to go on a sabbatical that would be funded through this sabbatical backlog fund. And that's what this is about. It's about a limited number of faculty across the system who could go on a sabbatical despite the fact that their college cap had already been met.
Thank you.
Representative Pepin.
Representative Lilly and Mr. Dale. So if they're on a list and they're not going, I'm not clear as to how that money is used. Do they get cash because they don't get to go on a sabbatical, or is it you've got it in a fund because at some point these professors or these faculty are going to go on sabbatical?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the money is used to refund the college for paying the faculty member's salary as prescribed in the agreement while they go on a sabbatical.
Okay.
Representative Pepin.
Thanks. I think, and I just have a couple maybe follow-up. I'm not sure. They might even be for Mr. Hubinger. Just kind of, if you could talk a little bit about the rationale for the increase. Representative Drazkowski mentioned that these are fairly generous. The first set was looked like it would be 8% for most people in that group, and 95% or 9.5% for at least 75% of the college faculty contracts. And I'm not sure that that's matched in the private sector. And just kind of, wondering how these numbers were arrived at. And then I guess that would be my question to you probably. And then I just want to clarify, I wanted to see the impact on the next biennium. And it looks like it's those two contracts alone would be over $60 million. And I just wanted to verify with Mr. Hubinger that was accurate. Okay, he answered me, but maybe you could just talk about a little bit the rationale for these increases that I feel that compared to the private sector, I don't see those increases happening, and I don't think the numbers would reflect that. And I just, if you could comment on that.
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the increases were arrived at through negotiations and in an effort to reach a voluntary settlement with the bargaining unit. It would be fair to say that I think that to some degree it's not probably rational to expect any particular bargaining group in the state service, having seen what other bargaining groups have obtained, to be prepared to accept significantly less. Having said that, this group didn't get steps in both years, and so that in some respects is different than what other groups have obtained. You mentioned that it looked like 75% of the unit or so got a 9.5% increase, but as I tried to make clear earlier, given the absolute dollar value of the steps, you cannot categorically say that. In fact, I mentioned the weighted average of the value. It is, in fact, not true to say that 75% of the unit got a 9.5% increase. That's simply not accurate. It would be closer to accurate to say something like 8.8 perhaps because of the weighted value, but it is not accurate to say 9.5.
And then did you have a question for Mr. Hubinger?
No, he already answered it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, I misunderstood because when I went through these before, I thought it was 3.3% in 2013 and 3% in 2015 and 3.5% for about 75% of the employees for 9.5% average over 3 years, because that's what it's written down in here. But I will, when I speak about this, I'll lower that number slightly. I guess that's all I have for right now. I am at the. I think the most telling thing for the committee should be Mr. Dale's comments, and I think he's right. It is hard to expect their bargaining units to accept a lower salary because we've given all these other bargaining units over the course of the last few years, the other contracts. I think we've approved at least 13. And Mr. Hubinger, maybe you can comment on this number, but I believe that the 13 contracts we've already approved have been over $400 million. Maybe you could comment on a more specific number. And so I think when we look at these, we have to remember that if we're going to give one bargaining unit 2% increase, then we can expect that we're going to give every one of these contracts the same or greater because they're not going to tolerate getting a less amount. So so while a small percentage here or there may not seem like much in a particular contract, as Mr. Dale rightly pointed out, it's going to happen across the board if it happens in one bargaining unit. So I think we need to be very cognizant of that in upcoming years. Thank you.
Was there a question there for Mr. Hubinger?
There was. I just wanted to verify that the dollar amount on the contracts. I'm sorry, I kind of got off.
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, the settlements that had been reached prior to the three contracts that are being considered today would have been a total of about $375 million.
Okay. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dale, on number two under the Comiskey College faculty contract. Is that then the way I read it there, it sounds like it's an automatic step increase, and it's been represented maybe by different bargaining units and different meetings of this committee that those aren't necessarily automatic. Help me out here. Where are we at?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, the item in number two, the steps in the MSCF contract are not automatic, and they are not. They have to be negotiated each and every round of bargaining.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Draskowski.
Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Dale, but after they're negotiated, do they then become an entitlement for every individual in the group that has not reached the top of their step, or is there some sort of evaluation around performance to make certain that they've met the eligible criteria to make that step?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, I'm not sure I'm going to get your question. I really fully grasp what you've asked, but each and every faculty member who's eligible for a step on July 1, 2014, that is those who are not at the top of the schedule, and those who were on schedule last year, the preceding year, will be eligible to receive this step without further analysis. There will be no continuing entitlement other than the fact that their salary has been increased as a result of the STEP movement.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Dale. That's a different description of the STEP process that I remember in discussion here. And I don't remember which group it was. It wasn't you, but it was a different group that was here. I find that to be somewhat interesting and deserving of additional inquiry. Number three, so we have in this contract, it appears really been 3 years worth of contracts that this particular contract is comes to agreement over. Is that correct?
Mr. Dale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the contract covers two fiscal years. It's fiscal year 14 and fiscal year 15. It begins on July 1, 2013, and the contract will end on June 30th, 2015. There are, in Mr. Hubinger's summary, three different items, numbered items, that he has, in which he has identified economic changes that will affect salaries. And if I may, there are some differences between contracts with respect to steps. So the fact that you may have heard a different description of step movement with respect to a different contract is not surprising, because the steps in MSCF are unique to the step MSCF contract.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Dale. I would just draw members' attention to a similar point that Representative Pepin began to talk about, and that's the increase to the base that each of these two contracts brings a 6.33% by one, and the other one is a 6.85% increase to the base in the next biennium. These are very substantial, and we are with the approval of these contracts at that high amount, providing a significant liability for the next legislature and the future taxpayers of our state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Pardon me? Right. So, just stick around. Might be further questions. But Ms. Cords, could you come forward and tell us about the nurses' contract? And as you're coming forward, Senator Eaton, have you had an opportunity to look at the minutes?
Yes.
And
I would move.
Thank you very much. Senator Eaton's moved the minutes. Any questions regards to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes have been approved. Thank you, Senator Eaton. And Ms. Cords, thank you for coming and telling us about the nurse's contract.
Good morning. My name is Marcy Cordes, if I may.
Cordes.
I'm the Assistant Commissioner and State Negotiator with the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget. Yes, I would like to present for your consideration today the labor agreement with the Minnesota Nurses Association, including the results of an interest arbitration award, and this covers the 2013-2015 bargaining round. The nurses bargaining unit covers approximately 760 registered nurses. They work primarily in the departments of Human Services, Corrections, Health, and Veterans Affairs. The majority of those nurses are assigned to work in the state prisons, the DHS treatment facilities and hospitals, and the state's veterans homes. After several months of negotiations last year and this year, the parties were unable to reach a voluntary settlement. And following a determination of impasse by the Bureau of Mediation Services, three issues were unresolved. Economic issues were submitted to the arbitrator, including wages. Mr. Hubinger's memo very ably covers the details of the issues that were submitted to the arbitrator and a summary of the award. Essentially, the state's position in the hearing was that this unit should be treated the same as the rest of the state's unions that have previously reached voluntary settlements, and the arbitrator did agree with that position. As a result, the changes in the financial terms of these contracts are consistent with other settlements approved by this committee in September 2013 and February of this year. Those include a 3% general wage increase effective July 1, 2013, and a 3% general wage increase effective July 1, 2014. There were also previously agreed to provisions, including progression steps in both years of the contract for those employees that are not at the maximum of their range. They are contingent upon satisfactory performance. Approximately 53% of the members of this bargaining unit are at the top of the range. They also reached a voluntary settlement on meal reimbursement increases that are consistent with the other labor agreements previously approved. Those are rates for travel increases, $2 for breakfast, $2 for lunch, and $1 for dinner, and that is a higher amount if they are in higher cost metro areas. The parties also agreed to the same insurance settlements that we have with other units, including an increase to the individual contribution for their health insurance premiums of 5%. There was also an agreement with this group to continue a student loan reimbursement plan that was established as a recruitment tool for RNs. The increase applies to the APRNs, and they are now eligible to receive $6,000 instead of $5,000 per year, up to a maximum of $30,000 per year. Payment of these monies are at the discretion of the agencies. This is a summary of the economic changes, and I'll take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Cordes. I have a quick question. How many of your employees are soon to be retiring, or what are you finding? I
think generally there's a feeling that there will be more turnover in the future. Specific data, we can certainly obtain that and provide that to the committee. I don't have specific numbers for this bargaining unit in terms of projections.
No. Thank
but
you.
There is a concern.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Senator Bowley and Ms. Cordes. I just wanted to verify the numbers that I'm looking. Do you have the were you provided with the information that was so well written by Mr. Hubinger?
I do have Mr. Hubinger's memo.
Thank you. That's very helpful to me. I like how he goes through it. I appreciate your work, Mr. Hubinger. You go through it on a line by kind of a point by point basis. It helps me follow along. I just want to verify. So the on lines 1 and 2 of page 2, it says a 3% across-the-board increase effective July 2013 and July 2014, and then merit increases on their anniversary dates. So I presume that that's every year. So for 13 and 14, does that total equal then 6%? 6% plus 8%, so a total of 14% for the 2 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, for those that have not achieved the top step in the salary range, they would be eligible for a 3% general increase and a 4% merit increase each year of the contract.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to know. And then I wanted to just talk to you a little bit about the student loan repayment reimbursement program, and I think I asked some questions about this last year about the about this reimbursement. And I know that there are some programs for lawyers who work for the state, or doctors if they go to rural areas, or for lawyers if they work for what's it called, services to defend low income clients. I forget what it's called, but I think they what was that
legal aid.
Yes, legal aid. But Is this for any nurse? Is it if they work in the metro area, or is it just rural area? And then I'm just wondering why that reimbursement exists, or how I understand it was negotiated. But is there? Could you maybe talk about is it such a work shortage? Or I'm wondering if it's harder in the rural areas in the metro, and if it seems to me that it would be easier to get nurses in the metro. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that whole program.
Ms. Cordes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the monies that are associated with the tuition reimbursement were negotiated in a prior round, and I believe the basis for that really was about recruitment. I don't have any data on whether or not it's more difficult to recruit in the metro area versus rural areas of the state of Minnesota. We can certainly ask the department to provide that information to the committee if you'd like. But it was established as a recruitment tool. And there have been issues with that over, you know, I think many years in terms of recruiting excellent nurses in our fields here at the state as well as elsewhere.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Lilly and Ms. Cordes. I appreciate that. I think a lot of other fields of work would also like to have some type of tuition reimbursement. It does get expensive, though, and taxpayers are paying for it. So perhaps in the future we could maybe try to look at those increases for some of the rural areas that, you know, maybe have a more difficult time recruiting nurses or looking at something. I have a nurse, or I have a niece that is a nurse in Fargo, and I told her about some of the nurses' contracts and what they get paid and the tuition reimbursement, and she about fell over. She could not believe. She felt it was very, very generous. So maybe I should send her over to Minnesota if you're looking. She said she had a hard time finding a job in Minnesota, which is why she went to North Dakota. But anyway, on the page 3, line on point 7, it says you eliminate the requirement that newly appointed nurses work 6 months before being eligible to take vacation, provide a credit of 40 hours of vacation at initial appointment, which is reduced by the amount of leave taken. So just wondering why we're adding that requirement, and if I were a nurse to come in and I work there for a month and then I took my 40 hours of vacation and then I quit, what would happen? Would I have to reimburse anything, or is that just my benefit? I can work a month and then move to a more lucrative position.
There are provisions.
Ms. Cordes.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, there are provisions in statute about recouping funds that are owed to the state if an employee leaves in a situation like that. That was established and is consistent with many of our other labor agreements and was established also as a recruitment tool.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know some members have to leave soon. I just have one follow-up question for you on that then. So would it be the reimbursement, is that for, do they have to, if my example, if it was 1 month, do you know if there's a certain, if they don't work the full year, would they have to reimburse on a kind of a prorated portion of the time that they didn't work to that year? Do you know what I'm saying? If I only work for one year, would I just get 1/12 of my 40 hours of vacation? In other words, do you know?
Ms. Cordes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, if I could get some clarification. If you do work for 1 year, you would accrue more than 40 hours of vacation under the labor agreement. 40 hours is 1 week.
Okay, but the 40 hours of vacation, if I only worked 1 month, but I guess I'm just trying to figure out what I would have to pay back. If I only worked there for 2 weeks, I went on vacation and I didn't, you know, I quit after a couple of weeks. And I hadn't earned that. You know, most jobs you have to work a certain amount of time before you earn your vacation. I'm just trying to get a kind of a quantified number on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I don't know if I can do the math in my head, and it would depend on the accrual rate specifically, but you would pay that back based on whatever your accrual rate is. So if you were accruing, for instance, 1 day per year, 1 day per month in one payroll period, you would pay back half of that.
Representative Pepin, we have an expert here at my side here. Senator Eaton has some expertise in this. Senator Eaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I work for the state, you earn a certain number of hours every 2 weeks based on your years of service. So I don't know if this allows people to take hours they haven't earned yet, but most people, if I earn 4 hours every 2 weeks and have 8 hours on the books after a month, I can take a day off. But I can't until I earn it.
So for this allows for initial, so it's the difference.
It allows you to do it before you've worked a longer period
of
time.
Right, but that's okay. I understand she clarified well enough. That's what I'm saying.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the SER-1.
There's been a motion on the floor. Is there any discussion? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just asked for a roll call to begin with, and just a couple of points, and I realize, as
yes,
Representative Pepin pointed out, that some members need to leave. You know, we see here again with the nurses' contract about 50% of employees, similar to many of the other contracts that we've seen over the last year. About half of the employees are going to get about a 14% increase across the biennium. The other half will get 6 or 7, depending on the contract. This one appears to be 6. Again, very generous additional benefits, $25,000 in tuition reimbursement, or $30,000 in tuition reimbursement. I don't know, Mr. Chair, where else in the world other than government that these types of benefits are available to employees. And, Mr. Chair, I continue to be troubled by a direction that we are going that puts forward these very, very generous contracts that the taxpayers of Minnesota, who, by the way, I understand, Mr. Chair, that the average net family income has decreased over the last 6 years by about $1,800 per family. We are seeing, in the face of that reality, these very generous increases. And I'll be voting no on the motion. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Senator or Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Just I get a clarification on the other contracts from Mr. Hubinger. Is the impact on the next biennium, Mr. Hubinger, is that around $9 million, a little more than $9 million, or could you give us a dollar amount on the nurses? The other one was over 60.
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, the impact on the next biennium of the nurses contract is approximately $9.5 million.
Sir. Thank you.
Senator Metzen.
Just a statement. I really believe that we have to pay people. And to retain good, hardworking public servants, I really believe they deserved a little bump here once in a while. And by the way, they're taxpaying people too, by the way. And sometimes we forget that. I mean, our public employees do pay taxes. And they helped us during a period there. There were 3 years where to get out of the recessionary problem. They stood tall and said, hey, we're part of the solution to this thing, and we're not going to take any pay raises for 3 years. So I agree with these three settlements, as I did on the last 13 or 15 we did a while back. So I second Representative Hillstrom's motion.
Thank you very much. I would agree with those comments, and really valued part of our team. We know we just got recently done with a lot of retirement speeches on the House floor, and a lot of them really thanked our staff, and I just bipartisanly, and I think this is something that, you know, I think we all value. It's just, you know, trying to get to the number. But thank you very much for everyone coming in. Sorry about the heat in the room. It's horrible, but Mr. Hubinger, please call the roll.
Representative Lilly?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Hillstrom?
Aye.
Representative Pepin?
No.
Senator Eaton?
Aye.
Senator Benson?
Aye.
Senator Saxon?
Yes.
Contracts are approved 5-2. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.